former National Association suffrage officers turned antis, Kate Gordon and Laura Clay promised to come, bringing their inside knowledge of Mrs. Catt and the suffragists' playbook, as well as their own powerful arguments against the federal amendment. They had proved so helpful in stopping ratification in the other southern states. Miss Charlotte Rao, the anti's national field secretary and fiery orator, was already on her way to Nashville. Pearson hoped that perhaps Ida Tarbell, the famous muckraking journalist who wrote wonderful essays opposing woman suffrage, might be persuaded to make a surprise appearance too. Pearson saw the looming fight in Nashville as a chance to display her leadership talents, show them what a true small-town daughter of Tennessee could do. The world was going to hell in a handbasket, Pearson believed, and she felt compelled to sound the alarm. The World War had changed things for women, and not for the better, she was convinced. Women had borne the traditional wartime burdens, as sorrowful mothers and bereft widows, and they'd rolled bandages and knitted socks for the boys over there. But in this last war, they'd also been unsexed, thrust into the brutish man's world in the name of patriotism. They'd been called upon to take up men's work, in the coal mines, in the fields, in the munitions plants, in the streetcars and elevators. They'd donned men's clothes and been paid men's salaries. And the worst part of it was, the women seemed to enjoy it. Some of them wanted to stay, even now, after the war, after the men had come home. They'd rather toil in a truck or a factory than tend the hearth, and that's how feminism was going to destroy civilization, she was certain. These new women and modern women weren't content with the sacred tasks of helpmate and motherhood. They lusted for things not meant for them, and it frightened her. Look at the suffragists right here in Nashville, especially the young ones, in short, clinging skirts, their legs almost bare, their corsets thrown away, flaunting their almost naked bodies on the street, their hair bobbed short and mannish, a cigarette in their painted fingers. It was disgusting, and it was dangerous. The ranks of the suffragists were teeming with, as she liked to call them, short-haired women and long-haired men, the kinds of moral degenerates who could hasten America's downfall. How much worse it would be if they were allowed to plunge into the muck of politics, too. Pearson was an educator of women. She devoted most of her life to shaping their minds and teaching by example their morals. When she was called to answer to her God, she wanted to be able to say that she'd done all in her power to prevent American women from tumbling down the road to disaster. Huddled around a table in her hermitage room, Pearson, Mrs. Washington, and the other planners all agreed on what to emphasize. The dangers the 19th Amendment posed to the American family, white supremacy, states' rights, and cherished Southern traditions. They would focus on making Mrs. Catt the living symbol of all that was alien and evil, ungodly and un-American, Bolshevik, and detestably Yankee. Chapter 4. The Woman Question. Mother Pearson was right about one thing. Abolition and woman suffrage did sprout from the same root, nourished by the rich loam of early 19th century religious zeal and moral reform. She taught her daughter, Josephine, that the causes were intertwined, and both were dangerous. The early advocates of legal rights for American women all began their activist careers as fervent abolitionists. They believed slavery was a grievous wrong, and they were obliged to confront and stop it. But even as they devoted their intellect and energy to this urgent moral campaign, often placing themselves in physical danger to do so, they encountered a striking hypocrisy among their male colleagues so devoted to universal liberty. Many a man who advocated equality most eloquently for a southern plantation could not tolerate it at his own fireside, was the way they described it. In the 1830s and 1840s, the South Carolinian Grimke sisters left their slaveholding home and risked their lives to speak out publicly against the evils of the slavery system, awakening the conscience of large audiences in the North with their tongues and their pens. As they drew greater numbers to their lectures, both women and men filling the seats, the Grimkes found themselves vilified by distinguished Northern clergymen and other high-minded abolitionists, not for their anti-slavery sentiments, but for their willingness to defy church teachings and speak in public. The clergy denounced the sisters for trespassing out of women's sphere of home and hearth, and spearheading these promiscuous gatherings. The sisters gave sharp reply to the men of the cloth, and kept on speaking out. Lucretia Mott, a devout Quaker, bore eloquent witness against slavery in her Philadelphia meeting house and in the National American Anti-Slavery Society, where she became a leader of the movement beginning in the early 1830s. Susan B. Anthony began as a professional organizer for the American Anti-Slavery Society. The sweet-voiced Lucy Stone was in high demand as a gifted abolitionist speaker, and Elizabeth Cady, already sympathetic to the abolitionist cause, also married into the movement. The willful, intellectual daughter of a prominent judge in upstate New York, Elizabeth was educated at the finest school open to women at that time, Miss Emma Willard's Troy Female Seminary, and was lured away from the polite parlor world of her social set by her cousin Garrett Smith, a firebrand abolitionist. Smith's country manor was the scene of a perpetual house party for radical reformers and fugitive slaves. It was a station on the Underground Railroad, and Elizabeth was mesmerized by the dinner table debates over politics and religion. At Cousin Garrett's house, she was introduced to a young seminary dropout, itinerant journalist, and anti-slavery agent, Henry Brewster Stanton. Elizabeth was charmed by Henry's persuasive oratory skills and his moral certainty. Their honeymoon was a voyage to London to attend the 1840 World's Anti-Slavery Convention, where Henry was an American delegate. Elizabeth's wedding journey set in motion a long chain of events that would lead, almost precisely 8 decades later, to Carrie Catt's trip to Nashville and Josephine Pearson's mission to confront her there. The British Parliament had already abolished slavery throughout the Empire in 1834, freeing almost 1 million subjects from bondage, so the focus of the London conclave was on strategies to eliminate slavery in other parts of the world, especially in the United States, where 2.5 million black people were enslaved. Among the approximately 50 American delegates at the London Convention were 7 women, chosen to represent their Pennsylvania and Massachusetts anti-slavery societies, groups that not only included women as full-fledged members, but placed them in leadership roles. The American abolitionist standard-bearers, William Lloyd Garrison and Wendell Phillips, insisted on this highly unusual gender equality in their American anti-slavery society, and the women had become adept at organizing, raising funds, and speaking their minds at public forums. Mott, a 47-year-old mother of 5, led this delegation of women to London. She and the 6 other American women delegates were rejected by the conference organizers. It was improper for women to participate in a public meeting. It went against biblical teachings on women's roles, and it was an affront to societal norms and sensibilities. Allowing women to participate would hold the meeting up to ridicule in the morning papers, the men maintained. That these same rationales, biblical views and societal custom, were routinely employed to defend the institution of slavery itself was an irony not lost on the women. Lucretia Mott and Wendell Phillips demanded that the woman question be put to the full convention, setting off a bitter debate lasting an entire day, in which 350 men postured and pontificated about women's proper sphere, how she was constitutionally unfit for public or business meetings, and how God's law made Eve subordinate to Adam for good reason. Mott was indignant. Elizabeth Stanton was infuriated. It was really pitiful to hear narrow-minded bigots pretending to be teachers and leaders of men, Stanton recalled in her memoirs. They would have been horrified at the idea of burning the flesh of the distinguished women present with red-hot irons, but the crucifixion of their pride and self-respect, the humiliation of the spirit, seemed to them a most trifling matter. The convention voted overwhelmingly to deny the women delegates credentials and ejected them from the convention floor, relegating them to an upstairs gallery behind a bar and a cloth curtain. When William Lloyd Garrison arrived several days late, he refused to take his own seat, instead joining his countrywomen in the gallery. "After battling so many long years for the liberties of African slaves, I can take no part in a convention that strikes down the most sacred rights of all women," he insisted. Their treatment in London was a galvanizing moment, an unexpected pivot point that stung many women into new thought and action, Stanton remembered. Mott and Stanton decided that once they returned home, they must gather like-minded women to their own meeting to discuss and demand more equitable treatment for women. It would be 8 years before Mott and Stanton managed to call together that women's meeting, delayed by distance, distraction, and the arrival of the first three of Stanton's 7 children. They kept in touch by letter and met whenever they could at abolition conferences, keeping the vague idea of this women's conclave alive. But their notions took real shape over teacups one midsummer afternoon in 1848. Mrs. Mott was attending a Quaker yearly meeting in western New York, not far from where Stanton lived. Sitting around a mahogany table, pouring out their frustrations to one another, Stanton, Mott, and 3 other friends decided to finally do it, to call a convention to discuss women's rights. The very phrase women's rights was an oxymoron, they all knew. American women possessed precious few rights under the law of the state or the nation. Elizabeth had learned this while still a girl, in her father's law office and courtroom, where she often curled up in a corner to read and watch. It was there that she listened to women beg Judge Cady to help protect them from a drunken, abusive husband. Men were not punished for beating their wives, or offer counsel on how to obtain a divorce and still keep custody of her children. Fathers retained rights of custody. They sought guidance on how to possibly manage on their own, as either a single woman, divorcee, or widow, with limited rights to their own money or property, or even inheritance. Judge Cady would listen sympathetically, shake his head, and patiently explain that there was little he could do, that the law offered them little protection, redress, or even legal standing. Women could neither bring legal suit nor testify in court. In one girlish fit of rage, Elizabeth decided to expunge the offending laws by taking a scissors and snipping them out of her father's law tomes. When he got wind of her silly plot, he explained that a scissors was not an effective way to change the law. When she grew up, she would simply have to convince the legislatures of men to change the laws. That must have seemed like safely far-fetched advice. Elizabeth was now a married woman, albeit wedded to a progressive-minded man. Nevertheless, she was, in legal terms, Henry's possession. Civilly dead, as she summed up a married woman's legal status. She was chattel, not unlike a slave. Henry was very often away on business or abolitionist work, leaving her alone to contend with all the chores of a growing household. They had moved from Boston to a very small town, Seneca Falls, in the Finger Lakes district of New York State, and she was at once overwhelmed with domestic duties, restless, and bored. It was the perfect time to dream of rebellion. "My experience at the World's Anti-Slavery Convention, all I had read of the legal status of women, and the oppression I saw everywhere, together swept across my soul, intensified now by many personal experiences," she recalled. "It seemed as if all the elements had conspired to impel me to some onward step. I could not see what to do or where to begin. My only thought was a public meeting for protest and discussion." They swiftly created an announcement to be placed in the local papers the next day, calling for a women's rights convention to discuss the social, civil, and religious rights of women, to be held at the Methodist Wesleyan Chapel in Seneca Falls. The abolition and temperance meetings the women were used to attending always featured a declaration of some kind, a statement of principles and purposes, and then some resolutions to agree upon and adopt. The five women leafed through history books and abolitionist literature to find a model, but nothing seemed to work. Finally, Elizabeth picked up a copy of the most revolutionary document she knew, Mr. Jefferson's Declaration of Independence, and read it aloud. This was it. It had both the eloquence and the fury they needed. She took it apart, line by line, paraphrased and substituted, and came up with her own declaration of sentiments, a litany of affronts to the dignity and well-being of women. The cadence was familiar. When, in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one portion of the family of man to assume among the people of the earth a position different from that they have hitherto occupied, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal. Mrs. Stanton's declaration of sentiments was every bit as outrageous in her time as Mr. Jefferson's had been. It brought up grievances ranging from inequitable divorce, custody and property laws, to prohibitions on women's higher education and entry into fields of medicine, law, and the ministry, and her unequal pay. It castigated the different code of morals for men and women, as well as a male society that degrades women and keeps her subordinate by destroying her confidence and self-respect. But the very first set of grievances Mrs. Stanton listed was, in some ways, the most controversial. He has never permitted her to exercise her inalienable right to the elective franchise, and he has compelled her to submit to laws in the formation of which she had no voice. Elizabeth was assigned to formulate a list of resolutions, a list of remedies and demands to emerge from the convention. A few days before the convention was to open, she read the resolutions to her husband, Henry, and he readily approved of her efforts, until she got to resolution number 9. Resolved, that it is the duty of the women of this country to secure to themselves their sacred right to the elective franchise. Henry was appalled. More equitable property rights, divorce laws, and access to education and the professions were one thing, but demanding the vote went too far. The vote meant making decisions for the nation. It meant power. And with all due respect to his wife, power was still the exclusive prerogative of men. If she went ahead with presenting that crazy franchise demand at the convention, Henry told Elizabeth, he would not attend. She refused to cut it. He did not show up. Even more rattling to Elizabeth was Lucretia Mott's reaction to the franchise resolution. "Lizzie, thee will make us ridiculous," the veteran reformer warned her protégé. "We must go slowly." One of Elizabeth's only allies on Resolution 9 was a 30-year-old black man who had recently moved to nearby Rochester to open an abolitionist newspaper. Frederick Douglass had escaped his own slavery just a decade before, but in that short time he had become the great spokesman and powerful symbol for emancipation. His autobiography was a bestseller, his lectures were electrifying, his fame propelled the movement. Even more, he was, as he would describe it, an unabashed woman's rights man, as he saw slaves, free blacks, and women all shackled by American law and custom. Very early in his freedom, he came to realize that many of the same arguments used to justify the enslavement of black people were employed to explain away women's subjugation. He'd already had long discussions about these parallels with Elizabeth Stanton, whom he'd come to know when both he and the Stantons lived in Boston during the mid-1840s. Douglas admired the courage and sacrifice of the abolitionist women who stood on the ramparts with him and financially supported him, and he decided to settle in Rochester precisely because it was the home of so many female anti-slavery activists. Douglas published the notice of the women's rights meeting in his newspaper, North Star, and he made the 50-mile trip from Rochester to Seneca Falls to see it for himself. The scene outside the Wesleyan Chapel was startling. In the hours before the meeting began, hundreds of people, both women and men, began arriving in farm wagons and buggies, on horseback and on foot. Stanton and the others had not expected this kind of turnout. The first day was intended to be a women-only affair, but there were too many men at the door to turn away. More than 300 people, including many young farm women, packed the chapel, listening eagerly to the spirited talks and participating in the debates, which stretched from morning till late night over the course of 2 days. They heard Lucretia Mott give several eloquent and powerful talks, and heard Elizabeth Stanton's first major speech. They heard Stanton read aloud the Declaration of Sentiments, and then discussed each paragraph. The declaration was passed unanimously by the meeting, and 68 women and 32 men stepped forward to affix their signatures to the document. On the second day, the resolutions were put forward, and the first 8 were easily adopted. Then came Resolution 9. Mott urged Stanton to withdraw it. Stanton refused. The debate over the suffrage proposal was contentious. Many saw it as a dangerous distraction from the more urgent legal, social, and economic demands, and it looked as though the resolution would go down in defeat. Stanton looked to Frederick Douglass for support. "I knew Frederick, from personal experience, was just the man for the work." Douglass asked for the floor, stepped forward.
"Woman, like the colored man, will never be taken by her brother and lifted to a position," he insisted. "What she desires, she must fight for. The ballot was the guarantor of all other rights, the key to liberty, and women must be bold."
His arguments, together with Stanton's, carried the day, if just barely. Resolution 9 was passed by a slim majority. Not only did Douglass turn the tide for the suffrage resolution inside the chapel, he returned home to Rochester to publish a highly sympathetic report of the proceedings at Seneca Falls in his North Star, accompanied by an editorial voicing unequivocal support for this new, grand movement.
"In respect to political rights," he wrote, "we hold woman to be justly entitled to all we claim for man. If that government only is just which governs by the free consent of the governed, there can be no reason in the world for denying to woman the exercise of the elective franchise, or a hand in making and administering the laws of the land."
Douglass would attend almost every National Women's Rights Convention for the next 50 years, and was one of the staunchest friends of the movement. Word of the meeting at Seneca Falls spread, producing a torrent of outrage and ridicule. Newspapers denounced it with headlines screaming, "Insurrection of the Women" and "Reign of Petticoats." Ministers, Bible in hand, delivered angry homilies about woman stepping beyond her proper sphere. Those who participated in the Seneca Falls convention faced derision in their own communities. So pronounced was the popular voice against us, in the parlor, the press, and the pulpit, Stanton remembered, that most of the ladies who attended the convention and signed the declaration, one by one, withdrew their names. Our friends gave us the cold shoulder and felt themselves disgraced by the whole proceeding. If I had had the slightest premonition of all that was to follow that convention, I fear I should not have had the courage to risk it. In truth, Elizabeth Cady Stanton was rather delighted by all the ink and vitriol spilled on the convention. "That is just what I wanted," she gleefully wrote to Lucretia. "It will start women thinking, and men, too. And when men and women think about a new question, the first step in progress is taken." Lucy Stone had just graduated from Oberlin College in Ohio, the first college in America to admit black students and women, and she was already sensitized to the inequalities women faced. As a teacher, she was paid half of what less experienced men earned. As a student, even at Progressive Oberlin, she was denied the right to speak or debate in public. She defiantly decided to become a public orator.
I expect to plead not for the slave only, but for suffering humanity everywhere. Especially do I mean to labor for the elevation of my sex, she wrote to her mother, who did not think this a wise career choice. Lucy quickly landed a job as a speaker and organizer for the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society, lacing her talks about emancipation with examples of women's oppression. Her abolitionist employers did not like her mixing the two causes, worrying that the combination would dilute their primary objective, or worse, alienate audiences. I was a woman before I was an abolitionist, she replied tartly, but arranged to speak for the Society on abolition on weekends, while giving her women's rights lectures on weekdays. She was a gifted orator, with great persuasive powers and a voice described as a silver bell. She helped organize the first National Women's Rights Conference in 1850, held in Worcester, Massachusetts, featuring a roster of illustrious abolition stars stepping up for the nascent women's rights cause, including William Lloyd Garrison, Wendell Phillips, Angelina Grimke, Lucretia Mott, Frederick Douglass, and a former slave who'd taken the name Sojourner Truth. Women's rights conventions began popping up all over the country, but abolition and temperance continued to be the prime focus of dedicated reformers. Then, in 1851, Mrs. Stanton was introduced to a 30-year-old teacher turned anti-slavery society organizer named Susan Anthony from Rochester. Susan Anthony was not particularly interested in the woman question yet, though she had, in fact, already confronted it. As a school teacher, she'd been paid much less than her male colleagues, and when she stood up to protest this disparity at a state teachers' convention, she was booed down for having the temerity to speak. Anthony attended her first women's rights convention in May 1853. This conference marked her conversion to the cause and the start of her life's work. When she once got fairly started in the women's rights agitation, a colleague noted, she made up for lost time. It also marked the beginning of one of the most extraordinary partnerships in American history, a collaboration that lasted for more than half a century and changed the lives of half the nation. They were a study in contrasts. Anthony, tall and prim, highly disciplined and abstemious. Stanton, plump and jovial, gregarious and indulgent. Anthony never married. Stanton enjoyed a long but difficult marriage and a large brood of children. Susan often came to live with the Stantons to babysit, giving Elizabeth a chance to write their polemics. Anthony always referred to her colleague as Mrs. Stanton. Elizabeth simply called her friend Susan. They were collaborators and co-conspirators, confidants and critics, clashing sisters. Stanton was thought, and Anthony was action. I forged the thunderbolts and she fired them, is how Stanton described their work together. Anthony would later teach Carrie Catt how to aim such missiles. In the 1850s, there was no official women's rights organization and no feeling among activists that such a structure was even necessary. It might be too rigid and cumbersome. This was a time for broaching formerly taboo topics, discussing them privately in parlors and openly at conventions, engaging in debate with doubters, wrestling with contradictions, and forging an ideology. It was the period, to borrow a term from a much later women's movement, of consciousness raising. Over the decade, the circle of women widened steadily, though it did not extend to the women of the southern states, where the culture did not allow for such questioning of social roles and relationships. At the center were Elizabeth Stanton, the new movement's philosopher, Lucretia Mott, its moral force, Lucy Stone, its voice, and Susan Anthony, its organizer. But those who advocated women's rights were still just a small segment of the larger, organized, more urgent push to abolish slavery. And as the nation veered toward a cataclysmic confrontation, there could be no doubt about priorities. During the Civil War, in a decision that presaged the one Carrie Catt would make 6 decades later when America entered the Great War, those who considered themselves feminist abolitionists
reluctantly suspended their work for women's rights and channeled their energies into the righteous crusade for emancipation and the preservation of the Union. Many abolitionists, including Stanton and Mott, did not support Abraham Lincoln's presidential candidacy in 1860, believing the Illinois senator was not sufficiently committed to the ideal of immediate emancipation for slaves. Even after his election and the outbreak of war, ambivalence about Lincoln persisted. Abolitionists spent the Civil War years pressuring Lincoln to actually break the shackles of the slave. Even when he issued his Emancipation Proclamation, many abolition activists questioned the sincerity of his motives. Was it truly an act of moral courage, or just a wartime expediency to undermine Confederate morale? And bemoaned the fact that the proclamation did not truly abolish slavery in America, only outlawed it in the rebellious states where it could hardly be enforced. What was needed was a surge of public pressure to push Lincoln and Congress to follow through with a comprehensive measure to abolish slavery completely and permanently by law, not just executive order. Better yet, by constitutional amendment. The abolitionists' ally in the Senate, Charles Sumner of Massachusetts, asked for help in turning up the heat under Congress.
"Bring me visible proof of the will of the people," he told the abolitionists. "Here then is work for you, Susan," Henry Stanton wrote to his wife's collaborator, urging her to join this effort. "Put on your armor and go forth."
Elizabeth and Susan strapped on their shields and put out a call to the loyal women of the Republic, convening a meeting in May 1863 of the group called the Women's National Loyal League. The goal, to muster an army of women into a massive grassroots effort to push for a stronger emancipation policy. This was a different sort of war work from anything women had ever been asked to do, a far cry from nursing or knitting or fundraising fairs on behalf of soldiers. This was political work, organized agitation for a governmental solution to slavery, utilizing the one legal tool women possessed, the petition. Women did not have bullets, Susan Anthony reminded them, and they certainly did not have the ballot, but the sacred right to petition the government for redress of grievances was enshrined in the Constitution's First Amendment, and it was not restricted to men. Now they aimed to use it, and on a larger scale than had ever been done before. With Stanton and Anthony in charge, the Loyal League was infused with a strong feminist flavor, and at that first organizing meeting they inserted a controversial resolution. There can never be true peace in this republic until the civil and political rights of all citizens of African descent and all women are practically established. As usual, there was an outcry from some attendees. Even William Lloyd Garrison protested Stanton and Anthony's transformation of the inaugural Women's National Loyal League meeting into a Women's Rights Convention. One newspaper called the meeting a witch's Sabbath, but the resolution was passed. Stanton became president and Anthony secretary of the Women's National Loyal League, and quickly built a structure and an elaborate outreach mechanism. League members wore breastpins bearing the image of a slave breaking out of his chains, and the motto, "In emancipation is national unity." Anthony, with her superb organizing skills, recruited more than 2,000 women to take women's emancipation petitions door to door, collecting the signatures of both women and men, white and black, and asking for a penny donation. Even children were encouraged to knock on doors to collect signatures and pennies, and were rewarded with a badge. The petitions were forwarded to League headquarters in New York City, where they were recorded and tallied, the pages pasted together and rolled into giant scrolls. Elizabeth enlisted her children to help, packed into trunks, and mailed to Congress. There they became the star props in a grand bit of political theater. On a February morning in 1864, two tall black men marched into the Senate chamber carrying sets of scrolls, the first installment of the League's petitions, 100,000 signatures strong.
They strode across the room and handed the scrolls to Senator Sumner, who stood to accept them with a dramatic flourish. He pronounced the petitions the prayer of 100,000 and used them to bolster his drive for a constitutional amendment forever abolishing slavery. In an extraordinary logistic feat, the Women's National Loyal League would deliver Sumner a total of 400,000 signatures, which he presented in batches to Congress every few weeks over the next year. It was the largest petition drive in national history, an undeniable demonstration of public sentiment that is credited with helping to convince Lincoln and Congress to push through the 13th Amendment. Stanton and Anthony could take rightful pride in the role the Women's National Loyal League played in realizing emancipation, but the lessons they learned from the process were even more valuable. They had just built and run the very first national women's political organization in the United States, a team of 5,000 members working toward a single goal, and they had seen firsthand the power of organizing women for political action within a strong structure. They had demonstrated women's patriotism, shown proof of their political abilities, and engaged a new and wider cadre of activists. The Loyal League was an ideal training ground for a movement that would usher in a new era of what Elizabeth called true democracy as soon as the war was over. Little wonder that Josephine Pearson's Confederate family prayed that the virus of equal rights, for blacks or women, would not spread. They need not have worried. As the suffragists would sadly learn, the political will to enact true democracy was feeble. Now, more than half a century later, the loyal Pearson daughter, Josephine, was confident that the political will for woman suffrage in Tennessee was still lacking, or, at the very least, could be stifled. Chapter 5. Democracy at Home. While Nashville's Hotel Hermitage buzzed with activity on Sunday, a few blocks away at the quieter Hotel Tulane, Sue White unfolded a large map of Tennessee, draping it over the bed like a stiff, crinkled coverlet. She stared at the long horizontal expanse of her state, pennant-shaped, with the southeast corner ripped off, fringed edges on its sides, where the Smoky Mountains on the east and Mississippi River on the west formed jagged borders. The three grand divisions were spelled out geologically on the map, the steep Appalachians of East Tennessee dropping down into the highlands and gorges of the Cumberland Plateau, then rolling into Middle Tennessee's hills and valleys, and finally smoothing into the flat deltas of West Tennessee. The state was sliced into thirds by the Tennessee River as it took its long oxbow loop into, out of, and back into the territory. The Mississippi River flowed by Memphis, and the Cumberland River curved around Nashville. The rugged beauty of the state, the mountains and hidden hollers, the plunging valleys and lofty knobs, the rivers and creeks and caves, all were a big problem for Sue White right now. The logistics were going to be tough. To cover 97 counties, some with only dirt roads and no rail, and 132 members of the legislature, Sue estimated that a woman's party campaign would require 15 organizers, two in each of the major cities, Chattanooga, Knoxville, Nashville, and Memphis, another to shuttle between Bristol and Johnson City in the northeast, and six more assigned to the rural counties, plus a press director at Nashville headquarters. There was no way the tiny Tennessee branch of the Woman's Party could afford such staffing. The National Woman's Party itself could barely afford her modest paycheck of $100 a month. Ratification campaigns in the states had been harder and more expensive than expected. The party had drained its bank account, and checks issued by headquarters were bouncing left and right. Alice Paul seized upon White's discouraging analysis of Tennessee as an opportunity. Miss Paul was a wizard at that sort of alchemy, and turned the report into a fundraising tool. She mailed copies to every Woman's Party member and possible friend around the country, distributed it to the press, and announced an emergency Tennessee campaign drive to raise $20,000 for the ratification fight. $1 from 20,000 women who wanted to secure political liberty for their sex could do it. Or a nice fat check from the Woman's Party's fairy godmother, Alva Belmont. But Miss Paul had not yet managed to pry open Mrs. Belmont's purse. Paul followed up with urgent telegrams to her best donors. Beg you to give largest sum you can spare in this emergency. Opportunity to win this last state will not come back if we lose it now. White had no idea if enough dollar bills tucked into envelopes would roll in through the mail at headquarters to enable her to execute a proper campaign in Tennessee. She would just have to work with what she had. She was used to hard scrabble. It wasn't just money that was scarce. It was woman power. The National Woman's Party, which had split off from the National Association in 1913, it was called the Congressional Union for Woman Suffrage then, did not have a robust presence in the state. Lizzie Crozier French in Knoxville and Lulu Collier Reese in Memphis were suffrage stalwarts who had crossed over the line to join the Woman's Party, but there weren't too many others. Back in April, Sue had tried to boost party membership with an impassioned call to arms addressed to the suffragists of Tennessee, virtually all of whom were members of the National, warning them that if they'd been misled by Mrs. Catt's organization into believing that ratification was secure, that it was time for a victory party in celebration, they were dead wrong. "This is a time for work and not a time for rejoicing," she admonished, giving a jab to the National's premature victory convention in Chicago several weeks before, when the 35th state had been gained and the 36th probably seemed imminent. "And if any of us have laid down our arms in the thick of battle for the purpose of rejoicing in a victory not yet won, or to partake in other work..." That was a poke at Mrs. Catt's new hobby horse, the League of Women Voters. "In the name of high heaven and the pioneers, let us once more put on our armor and strive to hold the line against the concentrated attack of our ancient enemies." The Woman's Party was still fighting. She'd enclosed a membership card, asked for 25 cents dues, and perhaps a small contribution. The response was underwhelming. The party had a bad reputation in Tennessee. White knew this only too well. Everything about the National Woman's Party irritated Southern sensibilities, even among ardent suffragists. Its federal amendment doctrine, its fierce opposition to President Wilson and the Democrats, and especially its combative, distinctly unladylike style. These had also bothered White at first, and she'd publicly criticized the party's tactics. But then the war came and made everything more complicated. When America entered the war in April 1917, Sue White dutifully followed the policy Mrs. Catt prescribed for all good suffragists, placing war work alongside suffrage work. She believed, as did Mrs. Catt, that suffragists could best prove to the public and to Congress their good citizenship, their patriotism, and how much they deserved the vote by pledging themselves to national service. White maintained her active role in the National Association's Tennessee branch, while also joining the state chapter of the Woman's Committee of the Council of National Defense, and used the organizational skills she'd learned in suffrage work to register 50,000 Tennessee women, white and black women, for duties supporting the war. Alice Paul and her Woman's Party, however, refused to support American involvement in the European conflict or participate in the home front war effort. For them, there was only one issue, suffrage. They picketed the White House, confronting the government that sent sons to die for democracy in Europe while denying their mothers and sisters and wives the rights of democracy at home. In Tennessee, as in many parts of the country, Alice Paul and her protesting ladies were branded unpatriotic, even traitors. White did not support the picketing, but she tried to understand the logic behind the tactic. "I see a determination, at any cost, to show the inconsistency of men and agencies who declare war for the right of Europeans to have a voice in their own governments, while turning a deaf ear to the right of American women to have voice in their own government," she reasoned. White continued her volunteer war work as well as her suffrage work, remaining in the fold of Katz the National, and was secure in her conviction that America was doing what was right in the war, defending democracy. Until the Woman's Party came to Tennessee and tested the bounds of democracy at home. Maud Younger, a Woman's Party star speaker and organizer, arrived in Tennessee in November 1917 as part of a tour through the South to explain the party's position on the war and the role of the picketing protesters. The first stop on the tour was Memphis, but no public hall would allow Younger to speak, branding her disloyal, pro-German, and un-American. White's sense of justice was aroused, and she went to Memphis to try to defuse the matter, defending Younger and the Woman's Party, calling the allegations against them base political slander. Still, she could not convince any meeting hall in Memphis to allow Younger to speak. Sue was appalled. "I saw, with my own eyes, a situation which was enough to alarm anyone who holds American ideals dear." Those ideals were being compromised around the country, as the Wilson government stoked a shrill patriotic hysteria, useful for pumping up support for an unpopular war. Newspapers were shut down, pacifist professors fired from universities, war skeptics thrown into prison, and German Americans accused of disloyalty under enhanced alien and sedition laws. "I determined then that if this same thing occurred throughout the state," White explained, "I would have to join the pickets at the White House gates, not so much for equal suffrage as for freedom of speech." In Jackson, where White lived and worked, antagonism toward the Woman's Party's picketing was so hot and sharp, and threats of violence so loud, that the mayor threatened to call off Younger's lecture in the local schoolhouse. White called the mayor, called the chief of police, convinced them that the Woman's Party meeting must go on and the visitors given whatever protection necessary. Miss Sue's word was golden in Jackson, and the lecture went ahead. But the scene was tense, and two burly sheriff's deputies walked up and down the aisle of the auditorium, watching for trouble. White continued on tour with Younger and the Woman's Party group for another 5 days, closing up her stenography office, her only source of income, using her political contacts to ease their way, acting as a sort of moral bodyguard. "Even if you do not agree with their methods," she insisted, "the Woman's Party had the right to speak. This was America, after all." When White returned home to Jackson, she was stunned to find herself the target of a barrage of hostility from, of all people, her sister suffragists. Her attackers included Anne Dallas Dudley, her friend and fellow officer in the State Suffrage Association, who lambasted her for cozying up to the enemy in wartime. The enemy in this case being not Germany, but the Woman's Party. Dudley slammed White in the pages of the Nashville Tennessean, and an accompanying editorial took White to task. The Memphis papers reported similar denunciations. Words such as disloyalty and un-American were used to describe White. Dudley and other Tennessee suffragists were anxious that the anti-war actions of the Woman's Party, which they considered a renegade suffrage group, not tar the entire suffrage movement in the public mind. White's friends resented the slurs aimed at her, but she refused to be baited. "I prefer to presume that my loyalty to my country is above reproach." Shortly after, White received a shocking message from the chief herself, Mrs. Carrie Catt, all the way from New York. Catt had read an editorial in the Woman's Party organ, The Suffragist, about White's cooperation with the Woman's Party emissaries in Tennessee. Catt jumped to the conclusion that White may have done more than just smooth the way for their talks. She accused White of being a turncoat and possibly a spy, suspected of revealing the national strategy secrets to the Alice Paul crowd. Miss Sue was insulted by the accusations, but not angry. That was not her way. She wrote her own calmly reasoned letter to Mrs. Catt, explaining that she had assisted the Woman's Party on its tour in an effort to uphold democracy and free speech, something all suffragists should cherish. Growing bolder, White also expressed her frustration with the National Association's abandonment of Tennessee and the southern states in the winning plan strategy. Kat's dual-track effort to pressure Congress to pass the federal amendment by achieving suffrage victories in pivotal states, all of them northern states. The Woman's Party was at least trying to wake up and organize in the South, White noted. The National seemed to have given up. After 6 months of letters back and forth, Kat presented White with an ultimatum. Take your stand, fair and square, one side or the other. White was torn, but this was not a time for sentimentality. It was a time for action. In spite of every effort to curb my militant tendencies, White explained to Kat, my mind continues to revert to the suggestion of Abigail Adams to her John more than 100 years ago, that the ladies might be constrained to foment a rebellion. Is 100 years behind the times conservative enough? Sue White made her choice. She joined the Woman's Party. Sue's relations with her former Tennessee suffrage colleagues were still raw and awkward. This sort of alienation played out everywhere suffragists traded the respectability of the National for the outlaw mystique of the Woman's Party. But the friction was even more intense in a place like Tennessee, where the movement was already splintered and grudges were nursed with pleasure for a long time. Both the National and the Woman's Party set their sights on the same ratification goal, but they insisted on pursuing it in their own way. Each conducted its own polling, lobbying, organizing, and publicity campaigns in every state. A very similar split had taken place in the British suffrage movement. Followers of the confrontational Pankhursts adopted militant methods and broke from Millicent Fawcett's more conservative organization. The American split mirrored this, with Mrs. Pankhurst's students Alice Paul and Lucy Burns pulling away from Fawcett's friend Carrie Catt and her National Association. But unlike the Pankhursts, whose forces attacked shops and office windows with hammers, planted small bombs in post boxes, and set fire to government property, Alice Paul was a pacifist Quaker, and the Woman's Party was never violent and anything but militant. Hoisting a picket sign, chaining wrists to a fence, and burning paper was as violent as the party's protests ever got. This sort of strategic schism isn't uncommon in social and political movements, especially when the struggle is long and success seems far from reach. Abolitionists fractured over the use of tactical violence as practiced by John Brown, just as Carrie Nation's saloon-bashing hatchet divided temperance advocates. The labor movement was riven by the adoption of the industrial workers of the world, known as the Wobblies, of violent means and later, in the 1930s, by unions' use of sit-down strikes. The mid-20th century civil rights movement would undergo its own splintering over the wisdom of violent resistance, with younger activists wrestling for power with the resolutely non-violent Martin Luther King Jr. Later in the century, the confrontational playbook of ACT UP would divide the gay rights community, while in the early 21st century, the controversial methods of some environmental and animal rights activists would shake those campaigns. There's always a tricky trade-off between the benefits of gaining attention from dramatic action and the risk of alienating the public and jeopardizing popular support. One thing seems certain. Such painful rifts within protest movements appear to be essential components of the ecosystem of change. That said, Sue White knew that competition could also have a nasty edge. White warned her party colleagues about Dudley, who inclines to hydrophobia at the thought of the National Woman Party. She explained, likening the reaction to a dire symptom of rabies. Guard against the cunning of our sister in arms, White cautioned, as Dudley would do almost anything to discredit our efforts. These were the same women White would have to cooperate with in Nashville. Sue White knew what needed to be done to win ratification in Tennessee. She had an instinctive feel for the political pulse of her state. She'd lived in Tennessee all her life,
and her years of working in the courthouses and organizing for suffrage introduced her to many of the political players. She knew their backgrounds, their professional alliances, their historic rifts, their personal foibles, and their soft spots. She was a loyal Democrat, but she could get Republicans to confide in her. She considered herself a progressive, but had a good rapport with the Machine Pauls. White was from West Tennessee, but she could make the Eastern Mountain men in the legislature feel at ease. She had forged excellent relations with Tennessee's junior senator Kenneth McKellar, a firm suffrage friend, and maintained valuable contacts with the staff of the profoundly anti-suffrage senior senator John Knight Shields, one of the two stubborn senators who'd held up passage of the federal amendment in Congress for so long. During the past few weeks, she'd watched with some delight as Governor Roberts squirmed under pressure from the White House and the National Democrats, who forced him to finally call the special session. Even now, she didn't quite trust him to carry through on the promise. She'd already tried and failed to convince him to convene the session in early July, so that the federal amendment might be ratified in time for Tennessee women to vote in the state primary elections on August 5th. A speedier ratification would also allow the women of 18 other states holding primary elections during the summer to vote. Roberts refused. White knew Roberts feared women might deny him the nomination if they could vote in the primary. The National Democrats didn't push him on the date, as the politicos in those other states were also wary of unleashing the unpredictable woman vote in their primaries. So Roberts set the opening of the special session for August 9th, after his primary and, there was no doubt, only if he won the primary. If he didn't win, all promises were off. Roberts really didn't want women voting. She knew that. If given the chance, women voters might well drum him out of office in the general election, even if he held on in the primary. The suffragists had a long memory of his years as an anti, and even anti-women were hearing those whispers about his very pretty and highly paid private secretary. His cronies, his advisors, were dead set against woman suffrage, and they were probably busy designing ways to kill ratification in the legislature without leaving fingerprints, if it even reached the legislature. White reported to party headquarters that just before Roberts was forced to set the date for convening the legislature, the governor's campaign manager was asked when the special session might be called. He replied, "I hope never." Both Democrats and Republicans, the presidential candidates, the party people at their conventions, were talking a good game now, but the truth of their campaign promises remained to be seen. White understood the basis of all this sweet talk as election season drew close. "So all the political leaders should be in a more or less amorous mood as they face the inevitable influence of women upon their destinies," she'd quipped to one of her party colleagues. That didn't mean that those men wouldn't try their darndest to postpone the inevitable as long as possible. Some people seemed to think that just because the Tennessee legislature had agreed to the limited presidential and municipal suffrage measure last year, and the governor, very reluctantly, had signed it into law, the legislature would merrily go along with ratification of the federal amendment. Mrs. Katz's suffs in Tennessee were touting this scenario, and to Sue's mind, it was nothing more than wishful and risky thinking. The limited suffrage measure passed the legislature by the skin of its teeth, even though it didn't face any states' rights objections or fears of Washington oversight. The federal amendment carried all that baggage, which would certainly cost votes. The East Tennessee Republicans who had supported the partial suffrage bill were probably not going to be so obliging this time around, lest ratification be fashioned into a feather in the Democrats' cap for the fall elections. And then there was the issue of the state constitution and the legality of the legislature ratifying. Some legislators were moaning that they would be violating their oath of office if they took up ratification, no matter what the Tennessee Supreme Court said. It was a convenient excuse to duck ratification altogether, but it might still be potent, and it might still hurt. Chapter 6. The Governor's Quandary. In the governor's mansion at the foot of Capitol Hill, Albert Houston Roberts punched his arm into his rumpled linen jacket and wrapped a too short tie around his neck. He was expected at Mrs. Katz's room at the Hermitage. He did not have time for this. He'd come in on a late train last night, after delivering 3 sweat-soaked campaign speeches on Saturday, and awoke to face a